From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. Over the last few months, we've been airing a series of stories called The Human Edge, about how we evolved into modern human beings. Today, we hear about religion from an evolutionary perspective. We'll explore how religious beliefs might have helped us become the species we are today. NPR's Elise Spiegel talked to some scientists who spend their time thinking about whether belief in a supernatural God conferred an evolutionary advantage.
Jessie Baring's mother died of cancer on a Sunday, died in her own bed at 9 o'clock at night. Jessie and his siblings closed her door, then went downstairs hoping that somehow they might manage to get some sleep.
You know, obviously we were all terribly upset, and my brother and sister and I were sleeping in the living room downstairs. And at about 7 a.m., 7:30 or so, the wind chimes outside of her bedroom window started to chime.
Jessie remembers waking from his long night and hearing the soft tinkle of these bells. And he remembers thinking that those bells carried a very specific meaning.
Seemed to me, sort of intuitively, to be a message from her. And I knew that my brother and sister were thinking exactly the same thing, that she was somehow telling us that she had made it to the other side, that she had sort of cleared customs in heaven, and she was telling us that everything was okay.
Now, Jessie was an avowed atheist. He did not believe in any kind of supernatural anything. He was a psychologist, a scientist, who believed only in the measurable material world. Still, he couldn't help himself.
My mind went there. It sort of leapt there. And from a psychological perspective, you know, as a psychologist, this was really interesting to me because I didn't believe it on the one hand, but on the other hand, I experienced it.
Why is it, Baring wondered, that even a determined skeptic could not stop himself from perceiving the supernatural? It really bothered him. It was a very good question, Baring decided, to take up in his psychology lab.
See, throw it just like that, but now throw it a little, and you're a little closer, okay? Yes! All right, you did it!
This is from a video recording of one of the many experiments that Jessie Baring has done in the decades since his mother's death, attempts to tease out how belief in the supernatural affects human behavior. Baring is a professor at Queen's University, Belfast. In this experiment, children are instructed to throw a Velcro ball at a Velcro dartboard and told that if they're able to hit the bullseye, they'll get a special prize. But then Baring gives them a list of rules that basically make it impossible for them to win the game unless they cheat. Of course, the researchers don't really let on to this.
So you think you can do that? Let me see. I think you can.
No, now, the children in this study were divided into three groups. The first was left alone and told to play the game as best they could. It was the same with the second group, with one difference. The children in the second group were told that there was someone special who was going to watch them. The experimenters showed the kids a picture of a very pretty woman, a character that Baring had made up, who, by the way, had the same first name as Baring's dead mother.
Maybe you have heard of her. Have you heard of Princess Alice?
We say that this is a picture of Princess Alice. She's a magic princess, and she can make herself invisible. That's what her magic basically is.
You know what invisible means?
And she's in the room with us right now. She's made herself invisible. You can't see her. But guess what? She's sitting in that chair right next to us.
So that was the second group. And the third?
The third group of children are basically shown an experimenter, a human being, actually sitting in that chair. So this person takes the place of Princess Alice, this invisible woman.
All right, let's see you do three more, following all the rules. The middle of the target.
Now, the question that Baring wanted to answer was this. Which group of these children is least likely to cheat? Remember, they've been given an almost impossible task. Well, the first group of children, the totally unsupervised kids, by far cheated the most. But what's surprising is the behavior of the second group.
Those children who were under the impression that Princess Alice was in the room with them were just as likely to refrain from cheating as were those children who were actually in the room with a physical, real, live human being.
A similar study with adults showed the same thing, that people are dramatically less likely to cheat when they think they might be observed by a supernatural presence. Now, before I explain why this is important, you should know that Jessie Baring has a credo, a truth he says he's learned over his years of studying this stuff.
I've always said that I don't believe in God, but I don't really believe in atheist either. Everybody experiences the illusion that God or some type of supernatural agent is watching them or is concerned about what they do in their sort of private, everyday, moral lives.
Of course, these supernatural agents might have very different names, what some call God, others call karma. There are thousands of names. But according to Baring, they all have the same effect.
Whether it's a dead ancestor, whether it's God, whatever supernatural agent it is, if you think that they're watching you, then your behavior is going to be affected.
And this is really important. In fact, Baring says that believing that supernatural beings are watching you is so basic to being human that even committed atheists regularly, involuntarily, have moments where their minds turn in a supernatural direction, as his did in the wake of his mother's death.
They experience it, but they reject it. Sort of override or stomp on their immediate intuition. But that's not to say that they don't experience it. We've all got the same basic brain, and our brains have evolved to work a particular way.
Baring is actually one of a number of academics scattered around the world who about 10 years ago started to look more closely at the nature of religious belief. Without directly engaging the question of whether or not God existed, they decided to look at religious belief through the lens of evolution. You see, in the history of the world, every culture, in every location, at every point in time, has developed some supernatural belief system. And when a human behavior is so universal, scientists often argue that it must be an evolutionary adaptation, kind of like standing upright. That is, something that is so helpful that the people who had it thrived and the people who didn't slowly died out until we were all left with the trait. But what could be the evolutionary benefit conferred by religious belief? What does belief in the supernatural get you? Well, according to Baring and some of his friends, the answer to that question has everything to do with what he discovered in his lab, the way that the kids and adults stopped cheating as soon as they thought that a supernatural being might be watching them. Through the lens of evolution, religious belief sets us on the path to modern life by stopping cheaters and promoting the social good.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, is that Dominic? Dominic Johnson is a professor at Edinburgh University in the UK and one of the leaders in this field. And Johnson says, before you can understand the role religion and the supernatural might have played in making us the people we are today, you really have to appreciate just how improbable our modern lives are.
Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Have you stayed with us before?
Today we live in a world where perfect strangers are regularly incredibly nice to each other. All day long, these strangers open doors for each other, they repair each other's bodies and cars and washing machines. In short, they cooperate.
Hi, what can I do for you?
This cooperation makes all kinds of things possible. Because we can cooperate, we can build sophisticated machines and create whole cities, communities that require a huge amount of coordination.
Enjoy your trip, and thank you for riding Metro.
Basically, by cooperating, we can do things that no individual or small group could do. The question is, how did we get to be so cooperative? For academics like Dominic Johnson, this is a real puzzle.
Explaining cooperation is a huge cottage industry. It dominates the pages of top journals in science, in economics, in psychology. You would think it's very simple, but in fact, from a scientific, academic point of view, it just often doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make sense because there's often a tension between the interests of the group and the selfish interests of the individual. Johnson gives an example, an experience he recently had in the subway.
When I was in New York last, I went down, put in my ticket in the barrier, and some little kid ran in with me and got through the barrier. So he got onto the metro and didn't pay. Now, we only have the metro if everyone pays, but there's an advantage for everyone if they don't have to pay themselves.
And what's true of the subway is true of everything. Why fight in a war, risk your own death, if someone else will fight it for you? Why pay taxes or reduce your carbon footprint? These all have clear costs. And from an individual's perspective, you and your offspring are much more likely to thrive if you don't get killed in a war or pay your taxes, if you behave like the kid in the subway. The problem is that even a relatively small number of people who choose to behave like the kid can affect the functioning of the whole.
Even a few cheats undermine cooperation.
Once people realize that they're paying for the same thing that other people are enjoying for free, they become much less willing to cooperate. Today, if you cheat, pass on paying Uncle Sam, steal a car, there are systems in place that will track you down and punish you. And this threat of punishment keeps you on the straight and narrow. But imagine if you lived hundreds of thousands of years ago.
We know that punishment is very effective at promoting cooperation. But the problem for human evolution then is, well, who punished in the past? Before we had police, before we had courts and law and government, there wasn't anyone formally to carry out the punishment.
In those early communities then, when someone did something wrong, someone else in the small human group would have to punish them. Maybe a leader, maybe just one of the group. But punishing itself is often dangerous, because the person being punished probably won't like it.
That person has a family, that person has a memory, and it's going to develop a grudge. So there are going to be potentially quite disruptive consequences of people taking the law into their own hands.
On the other hand, if there are gods or a god who must be obeyed, these strains are reduced. After all, the punisher isn't a vigilante. He's simply enforcing God's law.
You have a very nice situation. There are no reprisals against punishers. And the other nice thing about supernatural agents is that they're often omniscient and omnipresent.
If God is everywhere and sees everything, people behave. They curb their selfish impulses, even when there's no one around. Because with God, there is no escape.
God knows what you did. God is going to punish you for it. And that's an incredibly powerful deterrent. If you do it again, he's going to know. And he's going to tally up your good deeds and your bad deeds. And you will suffer the consequences either in this life or in an afterlife.
So the argument goes that as our human ancestors spread around the world in bands, keeping together for food and protection, groups with a religious belief system survived better because they worked better together. We are their descendants. And Dominic Johnson says their belief in the supernatural is still very much with us.
Everywhere you look around the world, you find examples of people altering their behavior because of concerns for supernatural consequences of their actions. They don't do things which they consider bad because they think they'll be punished for it.
Of course, these are all just ideas with no real way to confirm any of it. Unfortunately, it's not possible now to rewind the movie, so to speak, and see what actually happened. And so these speculations will remain just that, speculations. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
All Things Considered continues in a moment.
This year on NPR, we're exploring 50 great voices, singers who have made their mark across the decades. Today, the voice of Freddie Mercury. The late singer is best known as the frontman for the 70s rock group Queen. And NPR's Shireen Marisol Meraji has our profile.
Mercury is an element that stays fluid when the temperature dips low or soars high. Mercury is the Roman messenger god, wings on his sandals, moving quickly from place to place. Freddie Mercury was the mercurial rock star who chose a stage name in perfect harmony with his voice.
I'm a shooting star, leaping through the sky like a tiger, defying the laws of gravity. I'm a racing car.
He wasn't always the unstoppable British glam rocker Freddie Mercury.
The name we selected for him is Farouk. That was his birth name.
That's Mercury's mother, Jera Bulsara, from the film Freddie Mercury, The Untold Story. Farouk Bulsara was Parsi, a group with ties to ancient Persia, but both of his parents were from India. He was born on the East African island of Zanzibar, once a base for Persian Gulf traders.
In this very hospital, the government hospital Zanzibar, on the 5th of September 1946, Farouk Bulsara first saw the dazzling light of the world.
The film was directed by Rudi Dolezal. He portrays Mercury as an artist who mastered his craft in the West, but came of age in the East.
Mustafa, 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 Ibrahim.
Mustafa!
Mustafa Ibrahim.
For example, if you listen to a song like Mustafa, you think, I mean, this is very strange. I mean, what kind of cultural influences? Where does it come from? If you now know that Freddie was born in Zanzibar, then went to India, then came to London, which again was like a culture shock, then you sort of can see it's like a little bit of multiculturalism that was sort of combined in Freddie Mercury and the way he used his voice.
Freddie Mercury's voice was untrained and unpredictable, mercurial, throttling from an earthy baritone to a wild but heavenly tenor. Singer Adam Lambert spent hours upon hours listening to Queen, trying to figure out how Mercury did it so he could do it for his American Idol audition.
Mama just killed a man, put a gun against his head.
Freddie's voice it has such a texture to it. He kind of like grabs at everything. He squeezes it.
A virtual unknown before American Idol, Adam Lambert finished the season belting out We Are the Champions, taking Mercury's place beside Queen guitarist Brian May. But Lambert says no one can sing it quite like Freddie.
During We Are the Champions, there's that one part where he goes, "Of the world," and he holds that out for a really long time and it kind of like echoes off into the distance. You know what I'm talking about? Of the world. Instead of just being like open with like world and just singing it through an open throat, he kind of goes like world, like he squeezes it. Ah. And it's like, it gives it this like emotional intensity.
That squeeze gave Freddie Mercury the ability to hold a strong, forceful note that also trembled with vulnerability. Not quite vibrato, more like a shout on the verge of crumbling into a sob. The mercurial showman, Freddie Mercury could go from singing a ballad at a baby grand to high-stepping like a rock star, wielding a microphone that looked like it was just ripped from its base.
It was about the music, but he also really captivated the audience because he was so electric. That's why he's an icon, because you remembered what he did on stage. He had a presence. There's definitely something missing in today's music, in the scene. We don't have a lot of men on stage doing flamboyant or theatrical. We have a lot of female pop stars doing it, but where's that classic rock, pop showman?
Freddie Mercury's stage performance was humorous, camp, but he was very serious about entertaining the fans.
Freddie's deos, they used to call them. Because he would do the deo and all that kind of stuff, and the audience would do them straight back at him perfectly every time, and he was always quite amazed by that.
Jackie Smith met Mercury in 1982 after responding to a want ad for a Queen fan club manager. 28 years later, she still has the job. Smith always had a backstage pass to Queen stadium shows, but she preferred to watch Mercury from the stands.
The atmosphere was incredible out the front. There were, 120,000 people, I think, at the last show, which was Nevworth. And it was like you were still part of an intimate crowd. Because Freddie almost reached every single one of those people, even those right at the back. All we hear is Radio Gaga,
Radio Gugu, Radio Gaga. 240,000 hands in sync doing All We Need Is was like, oh my God.
Rudy Dolezal, director of Freddie Mercury, The Untold Story, adds that offstage, Mercury was humble and always put his voice before his ego.
I can tell you one thing about his voice, which I think is a unique story. We all know that Freddie Mercury had very strange teeth. And we would ask ourselves, well, a guy who is that rich, why didn't he change his teeth? And he was very afraid that if he would change his teeth, that his particular sound of how his voice sounded would go away. So his voice was more important to him than his looks. And I think that says a lot about the man.
The humble showman from the East and the West with a quicksilver voice. Freddie Mercury chose a stage name that represented who he was and how he sang. Shireen Marisol Meraji, NPR News.
You can see video and hear songs by Freddie Mercury at nprmusic.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Classes begin today at Northern Arizona University, and students may feel a little more pressure to roll out of bed and make it to that 8 o'clock lecture because the school is installing electronic scanners outside some large lecture halls. The scanners will track attendance. Our own tracking system marks down Arizona Public Radio's Daniel Crocker as present for this report.
Brandon Cruikshank has taught Chemistry 101 in this cavernous classroom at NAU for 15 years.
When I started here, I was of the mindset that this is college. Students should decide for themselves whether they want to show up or not. This is no longer high school.
But over the years, he's seen that attending class does matter. So now he factors class participation into his students' grades, most of whom are freshmen.
We do have to say to a lot of those students that it really is important that you do show up to class. You are not going to do well if you're not there.
Research suggests that missing even one class can result in a lower GPA for first-year students. And a freshman's grades in particular are really important, says Karen Pugliese. She's NAU's vice provost for academic affairs.
The stronger a student's grade performance in the first year, the far more likely they are to persist at Northern Arizona University and graduate.
Universities across the country are struggling to boost lagging graduation rates. At NAU, only about 30% of incoming freshmen will earn a degree in 4 years. About 3 in every 10 students drop out after the first year. And if something as simple as going to class could help turn that around, Pugliese thinks it's appropriate to make it a priority.
There's a lot of compelling things out there. There's a lot of competing choices that a student can make. We ought to, I think, do everything we can to make that choice the most likely.
Which is where NAU's new electronic attendance pilot project comes in. The school received $85,000 in federal stimulus funds to install scanners outside 20 large lecture halls, like Brandon Cruikshank's chemistry classroom, where it's not practical to take roll. When students flash their ID cards near a scanner, a light turns green and they get checked off on an attendance report.
I don't see why we need to be told what to do anymore. And I feel as though it's a move towards that, towards treating us as though we're juveniles.
Junior Rachel Brackett has mobilized student opposition to the project. She's launched a Facebook page, gathered 2,000 signatures, and organized a rally against the plan. She says part of the college experience is learning to make your own decisions and living with the consequences.
I really felt like NAU is not giving students enough initiative. They coddle us, I almost feel like, in a lot of our classes.
She also doesn't like how the school could track where she is in a, quote, Big Brother way. Linda D'Angelo with the Higher Education Research Institute at UCLA shares those concerns.
Rather than focusing on did students go, in other words, did they scan their card, the more important thing to think about is what are they doing in the classroom? Are they actively participating?
Universities also have a strong financial incentive to retain their students. It costs about $400 to recruit a single student to a public school, nearly $2,000 to a private college. Every time a student drops out, that process starts all over again. For NPR News, I'm Daniel Crocker in Flagstaff.
Humans have been telling stories ever since we began talking. Stories have become a kind of tool, as powerful as an axe or an arrow. In our series, The Human Edge, NPR is looking at the things that helped our species succeed. Today, NPR science correspondent John Hamilton has our latest report on how stories affect what we do with our lives.
Not so long ago, Sean Parker was waiting offstage at a club in Hollywood.
He was about to stand in front of hundreds of people and tell a story he'd been working on his entire life.
I was so nervous, I felt like I wanted to throw up.
It was more than stage fright. Sean says what was at stake for him was pretty much everything.
So I'm like, this is it, right? This has been the dream to come out here. And there's actors, and there's writers, and there's directors out here, and the people that are true storytellers, because I'm just some guy coming from Wisconsin.
Menasha, Wisconsin. It's a smallish city on the northern tip of Lake Winnebago. It has lots of paper mills and good sledding in the winter. And that's where Sean's story begins. Sean Parker was born in 1969. He's the youngest of four children. When he got to eighth grade, a teacher had the class write letters to themselves. The topic? How they saw their future lives.
I wrote, well, you know, what do I want from the future? I guess find somebody that I love and work in a mill, get a house, and have some kids.
That was pretty standard for kids growing up in Menasha. And it was pretty much what Sean's father had done. 4 years later, Sean's teacher sent back all the letters. When Sean read his, he realized he'd already started rewriting his future.
I like the idea that I was meant to be something more. I always said that we're kind of the sum total of the decisions we make in life. And I just felt like I could very easily make the decisions that lead me away from that path of being more, whatever it is.
So Sean started planning a life beyond the paper mills, beyond Menasha. Antonio Damasio from the University of Southern California says Sean was doing something we all do. Although we're not aware of it, he says, we think about our own life as if it were a story in the making. That's how our brains are wired.
You're constantly rearranging the narrative of your life. And you're rearranging it, of course, as a function of the experiences that you have had and as what you imagine your experiences in the future ought to be.
Damasio is a behavioral neurologist. He says humans have a unique awareness that their own lives are stories that begin when we're born and end when we die. And because we know we're going to die, we are not satisfied with just surviving day to day. To give our lives meaning, we strive for what Sean calls something more. Damasio says you don't see that in other species.
I have enormous respect for non-human creatures, but I don't think we're going to get them to consider this something more that they can be or that they ought to be. And this is what humans clearly excel at.
It's that drive that pushes humans to do new things, explore distant lands, and build great civilizations. We're drawn to tales of remarkable people, Odysseus, Joan of Arc, Muhammad, Confucius. Sean always admired his father. He was a pragmatist who never gave up. But it was the people Sean saw on screen that would shape his own life story.
I just was always amazed that I could go in to this darkened theater, right? And somebody was able to make me cry, able to make me laugh, or make me able to just have these emotional rides.
One movie in particular inspired Sean, Excalibur. It retells the legend of King Arthur.
Why have you done this to me?
Because you were born to be king.
What does it mean to be king?
You will be the
it
land.
It just speaks of greater things than ourselves. I remember seeing it and just, it made me want to believe in destiny.
And it made Sean wonder, how could he make something special of his own life? King Arthur was destined to defend his country against the Saxons and search for the Holy Grail. Damasio says something happens to us when we absorb a tale like that.
We begin by being spectators of a story.
Sean sees Excalibur.
And then very rapidly, we turn that into our own story.
Sean realized the Holy Grail was probably beyond his reach, and the Saxons weren't invading Menasha. So he focused on the quest for true love. King Arthur had his queen, Guinevere.
I had a couple girlfriends, but yeah, I got bored quickly. Like, it was easy to find fault and be like, is she really my queen?
Then he saw Heidi.
I was in the cafeteria, and I remember looking over, and I saw her walk in, and time kind of slowed.
Destiny. But for a chivalrous young man, there was a problem.
I was kind of stumped by the fact that I was a senior and she was a freshman, and that did not feel right.
So he decided to wait. He'd just be Heidi's friend until she was older. But it was hard. After 18 months, Sean decided he had to declare his love. He made Heidi a video. Picture a good-looking all-American kid with a mullet, wide lapels, and a long-stemmed robe. He's lip-syncing to a song called Wait. He never showed it to her. Instead, he sent her an old-fashioned love letter. And soon, he got a letter back.
Dear Sean, you are the best friend I have ever had. And she underlined friend in an infinite line that was explicit that I would never cross over.
Sean was crushed. Setbacks aren't unique to humans, but Damasio says our response to them probably is. We see them as changing the plot line of the life story we thought we were writing. And we cope by coming up with a new narrative.
In any moment of the present, we are buffeted between the lived best, about which we cannot do anything, and the future, the what next.
The point is, humans never stop looking ahead to something better. King Arthur deals with his unfaithful queen by focusing on the Holy Grail. Sean rebounds from Heidi by imagining an entirely different future for himself. He's going to make it in the movie business. All through college, he works on that dream. By the time he graduates, he has an entry-level job with Disney all lined up. And then, on the very day Sean is to leave Menasha, the phone rings. His father takes the call. It's his father's doctor.
The doctor said, you know, it's stage 4 prostate cancer. You know, you got to come in. So that's kind of where my life went on pause.
Another setback, major. And this one was to last nearly 2 decades. But Sean never gave up on the life story he was determined to write for himself, which is why, many years later, he steps onto a stage in Hollywood.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sean.
Tomorrow, how Sean got through those 2 decades, and how bringing meaning to our own stories helps us cope with adversity and even death. John Hamilton, NPR News.
And those reports are being told with the help of producer Rebecca Davis.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. That perky tune is a signal that it's time for All Tech Considered, and today we're going to consider the meme. That's M-E-M-E, and it's a word I've been hearing more and more lately, including on this program. And Robert, I asked you recently if you knew what it meant. You said you didn't know.
Me. No, I thought that might be Marcel Marceau misspelled.
Well, it's not, although I have to confess I had no idea what it meant either, and I started asking around the building. It did turn out to be something that the youngest members of our staff are very familiar with, the meme. Here's the deal. It has come to mean a phenomenon of popular culture that spreads like crazy through the internet. It could be anything from a Hitler film with wacky subtitles, or a clip from a newscast turned into an auto-tuned song. But if you're thinking that the word meme was coined by a 20-something hipster, you'd be way off.
I'm Richard Dawkins. I'm a retired professor at Oxford University, and I introduced the word meme in 1976 in my book, The Selfish Gene.
That's right. The renowned evolutionary biologist is the man behind the meme. He defined it as a unit of cultural transmission, a new kind of replicator that follows the rules of Darwin's natural selection. As Richard Dawkins envisioned them, memes propagate themselves by leaping from brain to brain.
Anything that's copied, anything that's imitated, so something like a tune that you hear whistled, clothes fashions or shoe fashions or hat fashions, these things spread through the population like a measles epidemic, and then they may jump to another population, they may decay. The whole thing looks very like the spread of a virus.
Well, then the task for you, I guess, back in 1976 was to come up with a word to describe this unit of cultural transmission that you're talking about. How did you come up with meme?
Well, I wanted a word that was sort of a monosyllable, a bit like gene, but which had some kind of connection with the idea of imitation. I asked a classical scholar who produced the word my meme as a unit of imitation, and I abbreviated it to meme.
At what point did it occur to you that this word was taking off, was sort of embedded in the language?
Well, it became a meme in its own right, I think relatively soon, and then, of course, it took off in a big way with the internet.
I started Googling and stumbled upon a Know Your Meme website, which has a whole series of videos. I don't know if you've seen them.
No, I haven't.
Okay, so they take internet phenomena that have spread through viral videos and discuss them, and there's a sort of a scientific veneer to them, humorously intended, a guy sitting in a white lab coat. And let me play you a tape of one. This is one of the examples they're talking about.
Very Meme Chief Scientist Yada here with information on a breaking meme that we've been tracking over the last several days. Standing Cat is the name of a viral video uploaded to YouTube in November of 2009 that, air quote, went viral in the spring of 2010.
Richard Dawkins, we got a breaking meme there. What do you think?
Yes, well, I mean, I think anything which spreads virally through the culture, through the memosphere, is legitimate use of the term.
When I'm thinking about you coming up with this in 1976, what was your knowledge of computers then? I mean, had you thought at all about how the rise of the internet, or just the rise of computers in general, might feed into what you were talking about? Or was it really beyond what you were thinking
about? I was pretty computer literate for the time, but neither I nor anybody else, I think, had any very clear idea of what this enormous flowering that would become the internet. It's become the perfect ecology for memes. I mean, the internet is now one great memetic ecosystem.
Welcome to our world.
Welcome to the world of memes.
Yeah.
Ben-Ha has taken Richard Dawkins' memetic ecosystem and made it his playground. He's the founder of the Cheeseburger Network, which runs a large collection of internet humor and culture websites, 55 of them, including
Failbook.com, which makes fun of Facebook, Very Demotivational, which is demotivational posters, There I Fixed It, which is homemade kludges, and we've got Ingrish, E-N-G-R-I-S-H, funny.com, which is horrible mistranslations from across the globe.
But here's the thing. Ben-Ha thinks Richard Dawkins' definition of a meme, an idea replicated from person to person, is too expansive a definition in the internet world.
When we say memes on the internet, it has a slightly narrower meaning.
You want a higher bar.
We want a cool velvet rope club.
Ben-Ha says an internet meme has to have added value. An idea has to be reinterpreted. People have to add their own signature or stamp. Or it has to be a part of a broader grouping, an added layer of cultural zeitgeist.
Somebody will look at a viral video and say, that's a meme. Well, that's actually a viral piece of content that gets spread from person to person, but that's not necessarily an idea in and of itself.
I want to play you a few examples here, and I want you to tell me in listening to them whether you would say they're meme or not meme. Okay, here's one.
Sure. In it, a cat identified as Rocky stands on its hind legs in order to look at something outside of a window.
Standing cat, meme or not meme?
Not meme. It's a viral video.
Not meme. Okay. Did not meet Correct. The standard.
Correct.
Okay, here's another one.
Double rainbow. Oh, my God. Double rainbow. It's a double rainbow.
Okay, this went everywhere. This is a song derived
right.
from video of a guy who saw a double rainbow and just went crazy.
Well, the guy who saw the double rainbow happened to be on ecstasy, and the guys who remixed that video into what they called auto-tuning are called the Gregory Brothers. This is actually a meme. The double rainbow meme has been mixed into many other things. So people have used double rainbow quite a bit, actually, over the last couple of months.
So, meets the standard of a meme.
Absolutely meets the standard, yes.
Okay, here's one more. Never gonna give you up, never gonna let you down. Okay, Ben-Ha, what do we got there?
Well, first of all, I'm supposed to be offended, because what you've just done is what's called rickrolling, and you have rickrolled me, and therefore
Sorry.
I should be insulted. Yes, I demand an apology from all things considered right now.
And rickrolling is?
So, let's say I sent you a link. Melissa, check out this great news story that I found. And you click on it, and you're confronted with this video of Rick Astley singing the song. And there's this moment of being baffled. I don't understand. That is rickrolling.
And meme or not meme?
The music itself and the song itself is what it is. It's a song. It's a music video. However, what you just did, where you rickrolled me, that is a meme.
So if I were to say to you that a meme really is defined as something that diverts many, many, many people from doing a good day's work, what do you think?
Well, that's probably an overly broad definition, but it's like a huge distraction from everyday life that people can participate and remix and pass on.
And Ben-Ha says internet memes are pressure valves that let us blow off steam in our daily lives. At least that's his story, and he's sticking to it.
Thank you.
Consider yourself Rickrolled. This is NPR.
This next story reminds us of an unusual case of heroism in World War II. It was heroism in the service of science. During the war, German troops surrounded the Russian city of Leningrad, as St. Petersburg was known. Hundreds of thousands died of disease and starvation during the siege. During this terrible time, a small group of Soviet scientists guarded a rare collection of potatoes and plant seeds. They feared that years of research would be lost. The scientists refused to consume their collection and were among those who starved to death. 70 years later, their research institute is again under threat, this time from real estate developers. Here's NPR's David Green.
The Vavilov Institute of Plant Industry is in the same building in downtown St. Petersburg where those scientists huddled during the war. But much of the institute's work takes place 45 minutes away in a garden that holds clues to different strands of fruit, how they can survive harsh climates, and which ones make people healthier.
Let's go. The curator of this collection, it's mine collection.
Leonid Burmistrov has been a scientist for the Institute for 40 years. Out here in the village of Pavlovsk, hundreds of varieties of fruit and berries stretch across acres. Burmistrov studies everything.
Like the winter resistant to different kinds of the fungi diseases or bacterial diseases and so on. What is the quality? What is the taste? And so on.
Until this fall, when the Russian government plans to sell much of this land to developers. The gardens aren't what they used to be, and weeds have taken over in spots. But Burmistrov says these plants remain vital to science. The idea of ripping them from the ground?
No, of course. No. It's not possible to think about that possibility.
Through history, this institute has had a love-hate relationship with Russia's rulers. In 1940, Joseph Stalin imprisoned the institute's namesake, Nikolai Vavilov, because Stalin didn't agree with his genetic research, and Vavilov died in prison. In the Cold War, though, the Kremlin was committed to science like this as a way to outshine the U.S. Today, the man leading Pavlovsk, Fyodor Mikhovich, still calls himself a simple Soviet director. He's written to everyone, up to President Dmitry Medvedev, to try to save this place. Sounding nostalgic, he says communist leaders would have supported him.
This feels like deliberate destruction, a continuation of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, when famous scientists were destroyed, along with the science of genetics. Today, they want to bury the legacy of the genetics founded by the great scientist Nikolai Vavilov. What will we, the Russian nation, have to be proud of if we ourselves destroy this?
A court ruled that the law is clear. A government property agency can sell off agricultural lands like this. It's not clear how much land will be auctioned, but much of the fruit collection appears threatened. Scientists here say it would take years to relocate the plants, and developers are in no mood to wait. They're poised to build houses for St. Petersburg commuters. Andrei Anisimov is deputy director general of the government's Federal Fund for Housing Construction Assistance. He's been on TV making the case.
These plots are not being used. The buildings are neglected and going to ruin. That's why the commission has every reason to make this decision.
Scientists from around the world have rallied to Pavlovsk's defense. There's a campaign urging people to send Twitter notes to President Medvedev. And on August 13th, a surprise. Medvedev, or the manager of his account, tweeted that the appeals had been noted and that the president had ordered an 11th-hour inquiry. But so far, though, no final word from the Kremlin. Scientists say there are few places in the world like Pavlovsk, and many of the strands of fruit they've carefully developed might never be recovered. What's more, says Peter Raven, director at the Missouri Botanical Garden, there's the symbolism of a collection scientists died to preserve.
In doing so, they provided a real model of drawing a line in the sand for biodiversity that's inspired everyone.
Only not around St. Petersburg, where people are more fired up about stopping the energy giant Gazprom from building a massive skyscraper amid the city's historic palaces. Many brush off the Pavlovsk situation as something typical in modern Russia, a spat over property that will just end up making somebody very rich. There's also a perception that Pavlovsk was lost long ago. 78-year-old Antonina Krekstina lives nearby.
Look at these gardens. They're neglected. They used to have everything here, fruit and vegetables. Now there's nothing. Soon they'll probably have to sell potatoes just to pay their workers.
Some of the gardens could be auctioned off as early as September 23rd. All the while, Leonid Burmistrov, the veteran scientist, goes about his business, as he's done for 40 years. There's a new strain of blue honeysuckle he's working on.
If they say us, boys, develop this crop, we're ready. Let's go to the flowers.
David Green, NPR News, Moscow.